From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with actor Peter O'Toole. He's been nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in the film Venus. He'll tell us about growing up the son of a bookie and about shooting the famous battle scenes in Lawrence of Arabia. The Italian composer Ennio Morricone, best known for scoring the spaghetti westerns of Sergio Leone, will get a Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's Oscars. We have an appreciation of Morricone's music by jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, and historian Christopher Frayling tells us about spaghetti westerns. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews An Unreasonable Man, the new documentary about Ralph Nader. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest today has played everything from God in John Huston's epic The Bible to a washed-up, drunken movie star in the comedy My Favorite Year. He starred in the historical dramas Beckett and The Lion in Winter. But the role he's probably most associated with is Lawrence of Arabia. I'm speaking, of course, of Peter O'Toole. O'Toole has received several Academy Award nominations over the years, and he may finally go home with one February 25th at this year's Oscars. He's nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role for the new film Venus. O'Toole plays a terminally ill actor who's longing for the young niece of a friend. In this scene, he's reciting a Shakespeare sonnet to the girl played by Jodie Whittaker. She's just stepped out of the shower and is wrapped in a towel.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and oft is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. Thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe and eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Terry spoke with Peter O'Toole in 1993, after the publication of his memoir. Most of it is about his childhood, growing up in northern England during the war. His father was a racetrack bookie. She asked him what it was like to have a gambling father.
I loved it in the pre-war years, when he was on top, when he was flush. I loved it. I loved going to all the tracks, meeting all the people, learning how to count by understanding the odds, memorizing the names of the horses and the jockeys, looking at the colors, the silks, looking at the animals, looking at the countryside. I loved it, and I loved, of course, being with my father and my mother. Times got a bit more grim when the war came and racing ended, but they cheered up again at the end of the war. Yes, in short, yes, it was lovely.
Did your father ever expect you to go into the gambling business?
No, he didn't. He might have expected me to, but he didn't encourage me to, and neither did I. Though I did gamble quite a lot until I was about 30 or so, then it petered out. I mean, for instance, Omar Sharif and I. Do you know Omar Sharif?
Well, not personally, but I certainly know his roles.
Well, he's a lovely
with
man.
You in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, well, he's not only was he in Lawrence of Arabia, but we've remained friends ever since, and he's a graceful and intelligent man, a lovely man. We were in Beirut in the better days, and we were playing, I don't know what we were playing, cards, and we lost all the money we'd earned in 9 months. We lost in one night in Beirut. And then a year later, we were in Casablanca, and all the money we'd earned in that year, we lost, but in two nights.
Well, did you have enough money that you could afford to gamble away a whole year's earning in one night?
Certainly not. But we did gamble it away in one night and then in two nights.
Were you drunk that night, and how did it feel to wake up the next morning knowing all that you'd lost?
Well, we weren't sober, but neither were we unconscious. We were fully aware of the pain and agony of watching all our pennies go down the Swanee.
When you were a young man, you went into the Navy. Then when you got out of the Navy, you got yourself an audition at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. You kind of talked your way into the audition. How did you do it?
Series of accidents, circumstances, blunders, a chum of mine who intended to be a painter and I hitchhiked our way into London to begin our lives, and we jumped off the truck, at a station called Euston, and we were aiming for a men's hostel. And the street which goes from the station to the hostel is called Gower Street. And we were plodding down it, and I looked, and on my left it said the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And my chum said, well, if you're going to be an actor, you know, that's the kind of shop where they deal with such matters, so why don't you pop in? So I popped in, and I saw a bust of Bernard Shaw. And I was looking at the bust of Bernard Shaw, and the commissionaire, the sergeant commissionaire, joined me at the bus, and we started yarning about Bernard Shaw telling stories, and he told me his stories, and I told him my stories. And then we were joined by a gentleman, an elderly gentleman, a burly, gruff gentleman, and he turned out to be the principal of the Royal Academy, and he asked me if I was a student. I said, no, I wasn't, but I was thinking of being, and one thing led to another, and I found myself, that afternoon even, turning up for the first interview. And then I did an audition, and then I did another audition, and I found, to my surprise, that I was in.
What did you do for your auditions?
The first one was a bit of Chesterton and a bit of Bernard Shaw.
What did you choose from Shaw?
Shaw?
Yeah.
Pygmalion. Mm-hmm. Higgins.
Do you remember the lines?
I've got to live here for the next 6 months learning how to speak beautifully like a lady in a florist shop. Yeah, that bit.
Now, you weren't from the kind of background where you grew up speaking, you know, proper English or the Queen's English, were you?
Well, it was the King's English in my day.
The King's English, that's right. Excuse me.
He popped his clogs later on. Yes, my mother always spoke rather beautiful. She was a Scotswoman. And as you probably know, the best English is spoken, I'm told, in Edinburgh. And she always spoke rather properly and corrected me whenever time I was improper.
Did you see a particular niche for yourself on stage when you were at the Royal Academy?
No, I didn't. I just rather enjoyed being a student in London and messing around, doing what students do and thoroughly enjoying the life. Then I was given a job at the end of 2 years. I was given a job at the Theatre Royal in Bristol, at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre Company, a repertory company. And at the end of the first year, having done about 12 or so plays, playing comparatively minor roles, I began to believe that I could do it, that I could act.
Were you given any advice about what type of character you would likely play?
Yes, I was. I remember one man saying, you'll spend your life or your early years popping through a French window with a tennis racket, saying anyone for tennis. But that didn't prove to be the case. I've never popped through French windows with or without a tennis racket and invited anyone to play tennis, or not.
Well, not only didn't you make your career saying anyone for tennis, but your first real big movie role was in the epic Lawrence of Arabia. Were you kind of surprised to get the role?
Astonished. I can't imagine anyone whom I'm less like than T.E. Lawrence. But that's what David wanted, I think, someone who could act it rather than be it.
David Lean, the director.
That's right, David Lean, the director. My master, a man I really did admire enormously.
So the movie was shot on location, obviously. Which parts of the desert was it shot in?
You tell me. we were in Jordan, and between Jordan and the Saudi Arabian border. I think sometimes we nipped over the border, but we didn't know, for it was uncharted desert. And what we would do, we were based in Aqaba, and there was a big DC-3, which would take off with the cameras and us in it, and then we'd find a mud flat and land and pitch tents and generators and all that and film.
So where would you live during the shooting, which I imagine took a very long time?
It took 9 months in the desert of Jordan. Where we lived in tents. Occasionally I had a caravan. We'd shoot for about 10 to 12 days and then have 2 or 3 days off. And I'd either go to Jerusalem, which I love, or to Beirut, Omar and I, where we'd squander our pieces at poker.
Oh, so that was the time when you lost all the money while you were making the movie?
In Beirut. Then we went off to Spain after 9 months in the desert. And I love the desert. I really did. I got involved with a Bedouin, and I liked charging around with that. Technically, I was there. I was there 3 months before filming started, and the idea was to learn to ride a camel.
Was it hard to learn to ride the camel?
Impossible. What you see is a European perched uneasily on the top of this huge brute, snorting and galloping.
It looks so uncomfortable the way you're positioned on there with one leg over the side of the camel and the other leg crossed over the hump.
Side saddle, precisely. And that there are two things that stick up like nails on the pommels of this wooden saddle. And if you ride a horse, you're finished because you can't post or anything like that. You just bounce. I found after a while that my bottom was bleeding from bouncing up and down on this snorting great dragon. And I went to Beirut not to gamble this time, but to buy sponge rubber. And it was, I remember, mucous membrane pink. And I arrived back to my Bedouin friends with this lump of thick, thick rubber. And I stuffed it shamelessly onto my saddle. And, of course, they were saying, But after a while, they looked and they saw that it was quite comfy too, and you could bounce more easily on sponge rubber than you could on wood and hump. So they began to ask me to buy more. So I was requisitioning tons of this damn stuff, yards of it. And I think I introduced sponge rubber into Arabian culture. The Bedouin call me Abu. They couldn't say sponge, so they call me Abu Svinj, the father of rubber.
Peter O'Toole speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with Peter O'Toole. He's nominated for an Academy Award for his role in the new movie, Venus.
There are a lot of scenes in Lawrence of Arabia where the camera seems to be almost several miles away from the people being shot.
Yeah, you're quite right. And that soul on the camel, all those many, many miles away, is invariably me.
Yes. Well, what was it like to know that you were being shot at such a great distance? And, of course, then, you know, the camera could, like, zoom in for a closer... they could zoom in with the lens, you know, for a closer shot. But that must have been pretty disorienting.
Initially, one was peeved. I remember David Lean saying to me... I had a stuntman doing it, all those shots that were miles and miles away. And David said, look through the lens, Peter, look at the stuntman. So I did, and he said, you see, no poetry. So I found myself being the poet, and I was the one bouncing up and down miles and miles away. But it was all right. I had a transistor radio plugged into my ears, and I had a cigarette going, and I had a little bottle of something in the saddlebag. I was quite comfy. And the man who taught me to ride and who did all those shots, of those amazing shots of the desert, was a man called Kutayfun Abu Tai, who was the grandson of the man whom Anthony Quinn played, Abu Abu Tai.
Oh.
Aouda Abu Tai. There was a strange thing. When the film was collected together again and the bits that had been missing were restored and glued back into place, we were in New York for the opening, David Lean and Omar Sharif and Alec Guinness and Anthony Quinn, the ones of us who were still alive. And having been introduced to the audience again, they were expecting to see this dark-haired beauty, Omar Sharif, and this blonde-haired little god, me, and I came toddling. We were like the Chelsea pensioners, these ancient old warriors came waddling into the spotlight. Then the lights went down and the music began, and there was a place which had been apportioned for us VIPs to sit, but I didn't. I just sat down on the front, all alone on the front row, just as I used to do as a child. And boom, on came the film. And when we came to those shots of the desert, I wasn't looking at the picture. I was just remembering what went on. Oh, that was the day that so-and-so broke his neck, yes. That was the day when so-and-so. And we came to this huge shot of the desert, And it's a scene when one Bedouin says, tomorrow, good riding. And it cuts to this huge panorama of the desert, the painted desert, the many colours. And the two of us galloping on camels. Well, that was Kutaifun Abu Tai, who was killed in the late 60s. And I was very moved.
What was it like to be in the middle of some of those chaotic battle scenes? Is it pretty frightening knowing that even though it's just a movie, things can still go wrong?
Well, there was the charge at Aqaba, which I shall never forget, because we were then in Spain. We'd left Aqaba and we'd built Aqaba in Spain. I know, this is the logic of filmmaking. And it was downhill on shale, about a mile and a half to the cardboard Aqaba we'd built, cardboard minarets, and we'd imported from Morocco plough camels. Now, your camel may look just like a great humped brute to you, but there are fine distinctions. In Arabia proper, we'd had camels called dhaluls, which are bred for racing purposes, and they're bought in Damascus, and they cost a great deal of money. And here we were with Moroccan plough camels who had never, ever had a thing on their backs and had never, ever gone quickly in their poor little lives. And I thought, this is going to be a bit tasty. So I looked at Omar, a gambling man, and said, what are you going to do? He said, I've been working out the odds. I said, have you really? He said, yes, I've been working out the odds about whether or not I fall off the camel or whether the camel falls over. And I've decided that the odds are very strongly on me falling off the camel. So I said, yes. He said, so I've decided that I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, really? Tie yourself onto a camel? Because we were surrounded by 400 horses. We had to lead, Omar and I had to lead on a handful of, what, a dozen or so, 20, 50 camels with 400 horses galloping behind us. And we had to lead this charge. And Omar said, I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, well, I don't want to tie myself on. Not really. Tie yourself on a camel. No. I said, no, I'm going to get drunk. He said, oh, I'm going to get drunk too. So we both got a bottle of brandy and we shoved it into milk and we swallowed back the milky brandy, which made us feel not a lot of pain, hopped on our beasts and did it. And I was described in one newspaper having a look of messianic ecstasy on my face. What it was terror compounded with slightly being, a little bit pissed. It was rather nice, really, on the whole. And we made it. We got to the other end all right, right to the sea. And I stood on my camel. We stood in the water and I looked, and to my right was Omar. And he was still tied to the camel. He was hanging on upside down.
Was it easier to stay on the camel being slightly inebriated? I'd think it would be harder.
Look, the prospect was being trampled to death by 400 horses.
Yeah.
So it seemed to be, if one was going to be trampled to death by 400 horses, at least have a smile on your face, I thought.
One of the films of yours I especially like is My Favorite Year.
That's good fun.
Yeah, and you play a washed-up actor from the swashbuckling era, a la Errol Flynn, who's making a guest shot on a Sid Caesar type variety show, and you walk in and you're soused all the time. Were you able to play off your image of having been a real drinker?
The first thing to say that he was not an actor, as he points out very clearly as he's going into the television. I'm not an actor, he says, I'm a movie star.
That's right. The
second thing is that, it did provide an opportunity for hilarious self-caricature, which I enjoyed thoroughly.
You were telling us about how you drank during the battle scene in Aqaba. How often did you drink when you were performing?
Never.
Uh-huh.
Never. You can't do it. You can't act and drink or whatever. You can't do it. It's impossible. You need all your faculties clear and pure and spinning. Can't have it fuddled and muddied.
Mm-hmm. How much acting are you doing now?
None at all.
And why is that?
I'm not acting. I'm not in a play. I'm just me droning on with a pair of earphones on at this furry mic in front of me.
Oh, I didn't mean right this very second. How much are you acting? I mean, at this point in your career.
How much acting am I? Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Not a lot. I'm doing more scratching, scribbling, writing.
Uh-huh. And what led you in that direction to start writing?
Well, I have a host of memories which I see very clearly, and though I'm fully aware of the tricks of memory, I'm also aware of the concrete nature of these brilliantly lit pictures in my mind. And they'll never go. They're ineradicable. I got a hint of how to do all this from a line spoken by a Spaniard many years ago. I don't know who he was or when he was, but he said, "I am I and my circumstances. Yo y mis circunstancias." And that clicked with me. If I could describe the circumstances of my life as well as me being in them, that was the clue to how I set about writing.
Actor Peter O'Toole speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. He's nominated for a Best Actor Award at this year's Oscars for his performance in the film Venus. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a fistful of film music. We have an appreciation of composer Ennio Morricone by Kevin Whitehead. And historian Christopher Frayling tells us about Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns, which were scored by Morricone. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new documentary about Ralph Nader. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. After writing more than 500 movie scores and getting 5 Oscar nominations, at age 78, Italian composer Ennio Morricone will be honored at this year's Academy Awards with the Lifetime Achievement Award. It's a big month for Morricone, perhaps best remembered for his distinctive scores for Sergio Leone westerns like A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Among Morricone's other film scores are The Casualties of War, The Untouchables, Bugsy, The Mission, and Days of Heaven. Tomorrow night in New York, Morricone conducts several of his scores at the Radio City Music Hall, his first ever American concert. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this appreciation.
Ah!
That's Ennio Morricone's theme from Navajo Joe, a 1966 spaghetti western starring Burt Reynolds. The theme was so over the top, it wasn't even used. In the 60s and 70s especially, Morricone had a knack for appropriate musical hysteria. He could pump up a bad movie, or one that just looked dumb, like Exorcist II, The Heretic, the one where James Earl Jones dresses up as a grasshopper. One Morricone trademark is unconventional use of the voice, which is as likely to giggle or belch as sing a melody. He's big on whistling, too, so his fixation is really about the mouth, which can make music without the aid of an instrument. This tack is psychologically shrewd. It adds a human dimension that makes even seedy exploitation fare seem more authentic. His scores relate to the movies on their own level. He reinforces Navajo Joe's raw male energy, and Exorcist II's 70s view of evil as a bad acid trip with the Doors. It's no accident Morricone's most memorable work was for the great Sergio Leone. He underscored Leone's wide-open landscapes where anything can happen. That comes through even in the way the music is mixed, with some instruments in close-up, some in the distance, and something bizarre always lurking at the edges. Spaghetti westerns were a riot of anachronisms, stylistic clashes, and messy grotesqueries that fit Ennio Morricone like a saddle. He'd think like an audacious director, making weird juxtapositions. He'd take you straight from Marlboro Man cliches to psychedelic effects that parallel what the Beatles were up to at the same time. This was 1966, the same era as Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane. As with most aspects of movie making, the composer relied on sympathetic collaborators. Morricone in his prime had his stock company of striking players, chief among them whistler and guitarist Alessandro Alessandroni. It's hard to imagine what Morricone's early music would sound like if he hadn't known a good whistler.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas. We're talking today about the music of composer Ennio Morricone, who'll be recognized for lifetime achievement at the Academy Awards later this month. Let's hear more about Morricone's music from Christopher Frayling, the author of Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone. Frayling spoke with Terry Gross in 2005.
the music from the Westerns is so, it's just so good. How did he Marconi and Leone had vaguely known each other in elementary school. How did they hook up as adults?
Yes, they'd known each other in the 1930s. In fact, there's a famous school photo where they're standing almost next to each other, taken in the mid-30s. But when Leone was making A Fistful of Dollars, he had to choose a composer, and he rejected the composer that the producers had suggested and went to meet Morricone. He'd forgotten they were at school together. But they talked, and they concocted a kind of anti-Western score, you know, that whereas the traditional Hollywood Western had a very symphonic, rich score, school of Aaron Copland or Jerome Morris, you know, folk tunes reworked as symphonies, they wanted something that was much more hip, much more related to pop. So you get a Fender Stratocaster guitar, as used by the Beach Boys or the Shadows. You get whistling, which is associated with kind of solitude in the desert. You get a lot of Italian folk instruments, the maranzano or jew's harp, you know, doing, 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 and a thing called the argillophone, which is a ceramic instrument with holes in it, where you get doo, that sort of thing. So it's Italian folk instruments plus rock music of the mid-1960s, and it was an astonishingly raucous, noisy sound, which became a huge bestseller as a soundtrack album, Fistful of Dollars. And it's nearer Tarantino than Aaron Copland, you know. It's kind of, it's like a pop music sampler. In fact, when I went to see Kill Bill, Part 1, Tarantino's movie, I thought he'd stolen my record collection. The soundtrack was absolutely those kind of things. But it's raucous, it's of its moment, it's youthful, and it's not hooked into the classical tradition at all. And it works, it's also a lot of sense of humour. It punctuates the action in a very amusing way sometimes.
And on the soundtracks of the movies and the actual movies, gunshots are used as if they're part of the score.
Yes. In fact, concrete sounds, you know, it was very trendy in the mid-1960s to experiment with music in the spirit of John Cage, the composer. And John Cage famously wrote a piece of music that consisted of silence. And the idea was the pianist would come in, sit down at his piano, and there'd be silence, and the sounds of the concert hall would become the concert. So the coughing and the rustling and the sweets being eaten in the bag and the shuffling of feet and the rustling of the programme become the music. So all sound is music. This was a very fashionable idea in the mid-60s. And they picked up on this for the Italian Westerns. Morricone was very interested in fact, he'd been to a seminar with John Cage in the late 50s. So gunshots and whip cracks and bells and choirs singing incomprehensible lyrics. Mm-hmm. I asked the choir master about the soundtrack of Fistful of Dollars. I said, what are you actually singing? You know, what is it? Is it Quick Get Back or We Must Fight? Or he said, I can't remember. It was just incomprehensible. They're just sounds, you know. And the human voice is used as another musical instrument rather than as a vocal line. So you get a lot of humming in these films. And it's interesting. It's sort of avant-garde music meets pop. And they're classic soundtracks, and they're a very important element in these films.
Well, why don't we hear the opening credit music from the soundtrack of the first Leone-Morricone collaboration, A Fistful of Dollars. And we'll hear those gunshots being used as part of the score in this.
Music of Ennio Morricone. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Christopher Frayling after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're paying tribute to composer Ennio Morricone, who will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the upcoming Academy Awards. He composed the scores for many of the classic spaghetti westerns. Let's listen to a scene from Sergio Leone's first spaghetti western, A Fistful of Dollars. Clint Eastwood is a gunslinger who's just arrived in a dusty Mexican town where he runs into a bunch of bad guys who start razzing him. They have no idea who they're dealing with.
Adios, amigo. Listen, stranger. Didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
See, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you went and fired those shots at his feet.
Hey, you making some kind of joke?
No. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize... I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
Why did Sergio Leone love Westerns? Why did he want to make them in Italy?
Well, you've got to imagine a child growing up in 1930s Rome at a time when Mussolini was the dictator and when most American movies were banned and those that were seen were dubbed into Italian. And the young Leone first saw his Hollywood Western movies in the 1930s at that time, and his heroes were Gary Cooper and Clark Gable and films like Stagecoach. And to him, they represented an absolute model of freedom. He lived in suburban Rome in cramped conditions, and he saw these wide open spaces, this unimaginable desert that goes on forever. He saw these characters. He couldn't understand what they were saying. He couldn't. He never heard In fact, he never learned to speak English, Sergio Leone. That's what's so extraordinary. But they were dubbed into a different language, not very well. But nevertheless, they clicked in his mind. Then, in the 1950s, when he went into the film industry, he found that nobody was really very interested in the Western. A lot of Hollywood veteran directors went over to Italy to make epics, films like Ben-Hur and Helen of Troy and Quo Vadis. And Leone hung around these films. Sometimes he was the assistant director. And he talked to directors like Fred Zinnemann, who'd made High Noon, Robert Aldrich, who'd made The Last Sunset and Apache and films like that. And they all said to him, the Western's dead. It's finished. We don't make Westerns anymore. So basically, Leone made Westerns because Hollywood had stopped making them and because in Europe, and particularly in Italy, there was this huge interest in the Western and a huge knowledge of it as well. So the whole thing starts in a kind of folk memory of American Westerns that went back to the 1930s, and it's partly political. But the other thing was that Leone felt that Westerns had got a bit talky. There was too much talking in them. He liked Westerns where Rin Tin Tin did all the thinking, you know. Old-fashioned Westerns where lots and lots of action and not too much talk. He didn't like psychology. You know, Freudian Westerns got on his nerves. Films like The Left-Handed Gun with Paul Newman where, you know, you feel if there'd been a social worker around, Billy the Kid would never have happened. Films like that, he didn't like. He liked films where, you know, a lot of shooting, a lot of riding, a lot of action, a lot of landscape. So he wanted to bring back the kind of innocence of the Western.
A lot of the Italian Westerns had international casts. So,
yeah.
So, and you can almost see that in the faces. I mean, there's something very, like an ethnic variety of faces.
That's true. And very often it went with co-production. You know, the Festival of Dollars is a co-production between West Germany, Spain and Italy. So you have Italian actors, Spanish actors, West German actors. There were a whole series of West German Westerns made at the same time in the mid-1960s, where the Native Americans are all played by Yugoslavians, if you're following me.
Yeah.
So you can tell the Native Americans because they're Yugoslavian.
In America, they're all played by Jews, probably.
And, you know, you're quite right. There's this sort of ethnic mix. But I think, and in fact, in, you know, in Once Upon a Time in the West, Claudio Cardinale, Italian, Charles Bronson, American, Henry Fonda, American, Gabriele Fazzetti, the man who plays the railroad baron, Italian, Frank Wolfe, an American actor who'd moved over after the Blacklist of the early 50s to Rome and was making his living in the Italian film industry. It's quite a mix of actors. But I think it points to another thing, and that is that when these films came out, they were treated as ersatz American movies, you know, carbon copy westerns which were trying to ape Hollywood. I don't believe that. These are Italian movies. I think they're really best understood as part of Italian culture and European culture. They were originally made, well, Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More were originally made for the home audience. In the 1960s, Southern Italian audiences went to the cinema more often than any other audiences in the world outside America. Southern Italian audiences went to the cinema twice a week on average as adults. There was no television in Southern Italy in the mid-60s. So all the cultural references are for that audience. There's lots of references to Italian paintings, to Roman Catholicism. There are bells and churches and monks and cemeteries and crosses and angels and the interiors of churches and the whole iconography of Roman Catholicism. I think one difference between the Italian Western and the American Western is that in the end, the American Western is a Protestant genre based upon a Protestant view of the world in the 19th century, whereas the Italian Western is a Catholic genre, you know, at that fundamental level. Not in an upfront way, but that's just the visual references.
Where are the desert scenes shot in Leone's movies?
The desert scenes were filmed in southern Spain, in Almería, which is actually a slightly different colour to the real American West. It's very yellow and olivey in colour. But if anyone goes to southern Spain on their holidays, some of the sets are still there, remarkably. They were built so well that the whole of the town of El Paso, which is built for a few dollars more, is there in the middle of the Spanish desert. And it's extraordinary. You're driving along and you come across this town. So, yeah, it transformed the economy of southern Spain.
Well, you know, because the casts were international, you know, we hear Eastwood's real voice in America when we hear the American version, but a lot of the actors are dubbed in the early Leone films, and you can tell they're dubbed. They sound like the old Hercules movies where everybody's dubbed. so that undercuts things a little bit, you know, because the dubbing is just so bad.
Well, it's interesting, you know, every Italian movie of the 60s was dubbed. It partly arises from building their major studio on the flight path of Fiumicino Airport. So planes go over all the time. They just didn't have the convention of natural sound in Italy. Everything was post-synchronized. Fellini, Visconti, Antonioni, all these films. And so the dubbing is not unusual. I think in the early Leones, because they didn't have much of a budget, the dubbing isn't very good. But I think the sound design of these films does have a quality of its own. The gunshots sound like cannons, and the cannons sound like nuclear explosions. Everything's pumped up on the soundtrack, and Leone once said to me that sound is 40%, at least, of the experience of a film. And that was quite new in the 60s, too. So there are pluses to the dubbing as well as minuses.
Christopher Frayling, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Christopher Frayling speaking with Terry Gross. He's the author of Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new documentary about Ralph Nader. This is Fresh Air.